Melodrama is the dramatic or literary form that sensationalizes evil and does away with subtleties to heighten its threat. Pay the rent. But I can't pay the rent. Pay the rent. But I can't pay the rent. You must pay the rent. I'll pay the rent. My hero.
The Tikva Fund presents The Theme of Evil, the fourth episode of an eight-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
At a certain point in this book that begins with the paragraph that alerts us to the difference between good and evil, at a certain point, evil enters into this. And it enters into it in a way which is much more disturbing than in George Eliot's earlier novels. And the most menacing figure here is Grandcourt. So one of the things that one wants to look at here is, in what way is Grandcourt so particularly menacing? Is this a villain of the old kind? Someone who is a criminal? Or is this a kind of villainy that we perhaps have not really encountered before? Then there are other forms of evil in the book to look at. One will come much later, and that is Mira's father, the evil that exists within the Jewish sphere, very different from Grandcourt. This is evil that, that really small-time theft. It says about him that he never committed larceny, but he shortcuts things. And this is a person who ultimately would feel perfectly comfortable with selling his daughter off in marriage. So that's a different form of evil. But I would say one of the things that we might note is that these are both people who function from the inside. This is not evil that comes from the outside to threaten you. This is evil from the inside. So let's see how that is developed. So at the risk of abstracting what the author would never simply conceptualize, I think we can identify three kinds of evil, at least, one from Gwendolyn's story, one from Mira's story, and following from what we've already said, one from British society in all its layers. So melodrama. Melodrama is the dramatic or literary form that sensationalizes evil and does away with subtleties to heighten its threat. I don't know whether you know this childish parody of melodrama that goes something like this, and forgive me, pay the rent. But I can't pay the rent. Pay the rent. But I can't pay the rent. You must pay the rent. I'll pay the rent. My hero. Right. So I think there's something satisfying about this elemental design that underlies the stories of both Gwendolyn and Mira, though it's hard to recognize the classic melodramatic scaffolding of the plot because the nuances and the details that humanize the characters are so really profound. So in this work, the connections between the villains and the heroines are intimate and familial, so that the girls are not merely victims, but they have some agency in either accommodating or resisting the men who prey on them. The kinds of villainy in these two strands of the plot are very different, and they're meant to suggest different kinds of wrongdoing associated with the English in one case and with the Jews in the other. I don't think that George Eliot exaggerates evil just in order to get us to boo and hiss the villains. The novel identifies the wrongs of its time to distinguish the new as well as the traditional forms that this evil takes. So the wickedness in each case is not threat from the outside, interestingly enough. It's not someone else coming from the outside. It's an insider exploiting the weaknesses of his victims. So Gwendolyn's gambling at the beginning and the kind of speculative investment that ruins Gwendolyn's mother tells us that this age of greater opportunity is bringing comparable risks. So in an evolving country with everyone hoping to improve their lives, how do we know when to welcome change and when to fear its outcome? The most menacing individual in this novel arrives on the scene in an atmosphere of optimism, of welcome. If Prokofiev were scoring The Approach of Grand Court, according to this book's description, he would be introduced by the string instruments that accompany Peter, rather than the French horns signaling the wolf. So just hear this passage. At the end of June, a rumor was spread in the neighborhood, which to many persons was matter of exciting interest. It had no reference to the results of the American War, but it was one which touched all classes within a certain circuit around Winchester. The corn factors, the brewers, the horse dealers, and saddlers all held it a laudable thing, and one which was to be rejoiced in on abstract grounds, as showing the value of an aristocracy in a free country like England. The blacksmith in the hamlet of Diplow felt that good time had come around. The wives of laboring men hoped their nimble boys of 10 or 12 would be taken into employ by the gentleman in livery. And the farmers about Diplow admitted, with a tincture of bitterness and reserve, that a man might now and again perhaps have an easier market or exchange for a rick of old hay or a wagon load of straw. If such were the hopes of low persons not in society, it may be easily inferred that their betters had better reasons for satisfaction, probably connected with the pleasures of life rather than its business. Marriage, however, must be considered in coming under both heads, and just as when a visit of majesty is announced, the dream of knighthood or a baronetcy is to be found under various municipal nightcaps, so the news in question raised a floating, indeterminate vision of marriage in several well-bred imaginations. So this is the society. So writing on the easel of history, Eliot, I think, mischievously situates the impending arrival of Henley Grandcourt at his Diplow estate in the context of the American Civil War. The way the narrator segues from the great American struggle to jockeying in the class system in England underscores this ironic descent from greater to lesser concerns and from greater to lesser democracy, right? That the news of a lord returning to his estate is of exciting interest to all the classes shows the value of an aristocracy in a free country like England. And the narrator is implying, I think, that the democratic process in England lags behind America's, where a truly momentous event has just erased the last legal liabilities against the enslaved part of its population. In England, what all citizens have in common is only the expectation of licking any bone the aristocrat may throw their way. The master of Diplow is returning to the area because of good hunting, but the people are also on the hunt. The satire is perhaps least flattering to those who seek their advantage through the mixed business and pleasure of marriage. They are in competition for the bachelor, who will elevate them and their family through the simple expediency of a wedding. And this is all part of the social satire, which is also part of this book. I think Henley Grandcourt is the most menacing character that Eliot ever created. Yet as we see from this anticipation of his coming, those who expect to profit from him are part of the system that allows him to function as he does, and they cannot be considered altogether blameless. Gwendolyn, who excels in competition and who conceives of herself as someone special without knowing what is going to make her special, is an obvious candidate for the advantages that such a man offers. That England is a free country allows her to change her social status by marrying up, and she assumes that the choice is hers to make. She does not perceive that a person she intends to use for such advantage may be seeking a different kind of advantage through her. She assumes that aristocratic bearing goes along with an aristocratic sensibility, ignoring the forces encouraging her newfound freedom of movement, have also liberated the titled class from any of its former responsibilities. And I think it's clear that she mistakes manners for real gentlemanliness. She does not see that this haughtiness has something very sinister as part of it. Now, Irving Howe, who is an American Jewish literary critic, a very, very good literary critic, and he wrote about politics and the novel, he suggests that Grand Court represents a new image of radical evil that enjoys power for its own sake and is tempted by power into acts of sadistic cruelty. Possibly, I think, the most chilling warning we have of this, portend that we have of this cruelty, comes early on when Grand Court, who is now agreeably ensconced at Diplo, is seated at the breakfast table in the company of his factotum, Mr. Lush, and two dogs, one on his lap and one at his feet. We watch, I think, in morbid fascination as he coddles the tiny pet in his lap in order to provoke the envy of the one called Fetch, who whimpers and tries in vain to win some of his master's affection. The narrator tells us Grand Court kept so many dogs that he was reputed to love them. But not unless sadism is a sign of love can we accept any such possibility. It's no surprise to see Grand Court treating Lush as contemptuously as he handles his pets. And in fact, the narrator tells us, his pet dogs were not the only beings that Grand Court liked to feel his power over in making them jealous. So this scene, though, takes place in private, and there is no one to warn Gwendolyn about his brutal behavior, about this brutal aspect of his personality. She is under the delightful illusion that should she marry this man, she could use her charm to rule over him. So charm him she does, but Lush, who is eager to prevent the marriage that would leave him unemployed, makes Gwendolyn aware of Grand Court's past, of the fact that he has a mistress who has borne him four children. And it's interesting that the two victims of Grand Court, Lush and Mrs. Glasher, then plot against Gwendolyn. And Lydia Glasher's sinister warning to Gwendolyn is also an aggression, and it's an aggression that she justifies as payback for the evil that she experienced at his hands. You are very attractive, Miss Harleth, but when he first knew me, I too was young. Since then, my life has been broken up and embittered. It is not fair that he should be happy and I miserable, and my boy thrust out of sight for another. The sinned against women are also sinners. Mrs. Glasher had once deserted her child when she left her husband. Her appeal to Gwendolyn's conscience succeeds, and Gwendolyn's, I would say, subsequent reckless behavior at the gambling table may be explained in part by this flight from Grand Court's grand courtship. We know that she is very impressionable. In fact, her resolution on the side of goodness and caution is quickly challenged, tested by her family's collapse into poverty and by the prospect of being a governess that is so grim that it rehabilitates the unacceptable. Gwendolyn has a conscience. That we know from the start. Her conscience told her what she owed Lydia. But she gave less thought to the nature of the man who had helped bring Lydia to ruin. So when Gwendolyn does agree to marry Grandcourt as the better alternative to becoming a governess, she thinks she has the upper hand. She thinks she is doing something wrong, but she does not suspect in the least the trap that is being sprung for her. So it's interesting that she thinks she is doing wrong, but in the meantime, there is an evil far greater that is menacing her. She prepares to receive the proposal. We are told she was not now going to crave an opinion of her capabilities as she had done in the interview with Klesmer. She was going to exercise her power. Look at the mistake here. He is so mistaken. Klesmer, she thinks she is under his power because he told her what was wrong with her. But that was really telling her what was right. He was trying to tell her the truth. He was trying to help her through her future. But now Grandcourt, she does not suspect, and she thinks that he has the power over her. We see that she does not see that there is a real kind of mistaken set of assumptions about her. And as Grandcourt awaits her answer, at that moment, his strongest wish was to be completely master of this creature, this piquant combination of maidenliness and mischief. The words and concepts of power and mastery recur in all the relations between Mr. and Mrs. Grandcourt. Their union is a struggle for power, with the advantages all on the husband's side, that is, until he's on the point of drowning. Grandcourt's advantage over everyone, his wife emphatically included, is his lack of anything that we would call conscience. He has no empathy, affection, compassion, responsiveness, any kind of fellow feeling. He belongs to a hollowed out aristocracy with no designated function, whose social advantage and sense of superiority are in no way warranted. At one point, dear Mr. Gascoigne, that is Gwendolyn's clergyman uncle, suggests that Grandcourt should be standing for Parliament, assuming that anyone with such natural advantages could help in decision-making and governance, with not the slightest insight into the kind of man this is, of the contempt that he feels for the populace, for whom he calls the brutes. Now, the guilt that Lady Malinger feels for not having given her husband a son and heir stands for the kind of guilt of a titled class that she feels is no longer contributing to the country's future welfare. She feels guilty. And this is, of course, part of a satire of a political system that does not know how to reform itself. But Henley Grandcourt, he feels no compunction. He feels only a sense of dullness and boredom, and instead of trying to be of some use, he takes pleasure in submitting others to his will. All the ideas that were consolidating in continental philosophy through Schopenhauer and later Nietzsche about the will to power as a supreme human impulse are manifest in Grandcourt in negative and dangerous form. Now, I mentioned Irving Howe and his article about Daniel Deronda and radical evil, because in this, he takes this a giant step further, and he finds in Grandcourt the prototype of the evil colonizer. He cites as evidence the following description of him that comes when he is demonstrating his mastery over Gwendolyn, who has acted against his will. He knew the force of his own words. If this white-handed man with the perpendicular profile had been sent to govern a difficult colony, he might have won reputation among his contemporaries. He had certainly ability, would have understood that it was safer to exterminate than to cajole superseded proprietors, and would not have flinched from making things safe in that way. So, just as George Eliot's portrait of Deronda is said to have adumbrated the rise of political Zionism, Howe suggests that Grand Court's nature conveys the evils of British imperialism and foretells the rise of fascism in its most brutal form as political power that gains its sense of superiority from the subjugation of others who count for so little that they may be eliminated if caution demands. We see in Grand Court then how an aristocracy that loses its purpose without yet losing its material and social advantages may turn decadent, and how this decadence finds its purpose in brutality. Now, the menace that pursues Mira is altogether different, and its function in the book is less prominent. Whereas Grand Court spreads his evil at his pleasure, the only ones threatened by Lapidoth are the members of his family, at least here, whose subjugation is achieved by an appeal, of all things, an appeal to their loyalty. The political and the sociological, the anthropological, the cultural, and the demographic conditions of diaspora Jewry had created patterns of behavior that were in some ways opposite to those of the nations among whom they lived, and whose pleasure they had in some ways always to serve. As a result of the way in which Jews earned their living, that were themselves a result of the Jewish way of life in exile, their criminality was also distinctive. In Europe, they were statistically underrepresented in capital crimes of violence and passion, but often overrepresented, seriously overrepresented, in economic transgressions like smuggling, theft, gambling, prostitution. Lapidoth specializes in those lesser crimes that sometimes, however, have fatal repercussions. He steals his daughter from her mother and tries to make her his meal ticket by training her for a career as a singer, training that serves her well, despite the coercive nature of her instruction. But when her talent doesn't rise to the level of his ambition, he tries to sell her in marriage. He becomes a gambler, a vice that overwhelms even his rational self-interest, so that we find him stealing from his children, who were prepared to provide for him. There is evil among Jews, to be sure, but Lapidoth slinks around the edges of his community, not at the center, but rather as a marginal feature of Jewish life. I think here it is worth noting, and making a point of this, that Mira's susceptibility comes through her loyalty to her father. That is what he is able to exploit. So you see that the same kinds of features of a society that may lead to its greatest strengths are also its vulnerabilities and can be exploited by anyone who wants to use them for evil purposes. I don't think the book is on quite the same confident footing with Lapidoth as it is with Grand Court. And here Eliot may be working less from real life, and certainly less from her own experience, than from literary models. The Wicked Jew was such a staple of English literature, and consequently of the reader's expectations, that she may have felt obliged to include at least one such portrait in a novel that pretended to be true to life. Evil Jews, as many of you know, I'm sure, have appeared in England and in English literature from the Nun's Tale in Chaucer through Marlowe's Jew of Malta and Shakespeare's Shylock through Fagin, the Master of Picking Pockets, and Oliver Twist to the Bernie Madoff forerunner, Augustus Melot, in Anthony Trollope's The Way We Live Now. But British writers conceived of the deniers of Christ as dangerous aliens whose proffered services were never to be trusted. And despite her intention of reversing that stereotype, or rather, maybe because she thought she could not hope to reverse that stereotype without acknowledging some measure of its truth, Eliot includes among the sympathetic Jewish booksellers and pawnbrokers in this book the musicians, debaters, and visionaries this nasty man who remains true to his deceitful type. Lapidoth does not make it into the pantheon of Jewish villains in English literature, preying, as I say, mostly on his own family and on Deronda only at the point where he is already known to be a Jew. He is a low-grade schemer. Now, whereas Grandcourt's sadism and Lapidoth's scheming are specific to certain types of sinner, anti-Jewish prejudice is a social evil that sees a crook and gambler like Lapidoth behind every Jew. And this chauvinism is, for Eliot, a symptom of the rotten part of British nationalism. Anti-Jewish prejudice that experiences worth in disdain for others comes to its dangerous zenith in Grandcourt's abuse of power. It exists, however, at every level of society, as we see from, I will just give a small sampling of the kinds of prejudice acknowledged or felt by many of its characters. So, from high society, Mr. Bolt, one of the suitors of Miss Arrowsmith, of Miss Arrow Point, regarding possible rivalry from a Jew, says, "Klezmer he hardly regarded in the light of a serious human being who ought to have a vote." Now, this was, of course, a time when the discussion of rights for Jews as voters and a standing for parliament was being discussed. But he says, hardly seemed to him a serious human being who ought to have a vote. Now, the generally kindly Lady Malinger, responding to Deronda's request that Mira be invited to a home reception, "I am sorry she is a bigoted Jewess. I should not like it for anything else, but it doesn't matter in singing." The more biting Lady Pantruff about Mira, "Well, your Jewess is pretty. There's no denying that, but where is her Jewish impudence? She looks as demure as a nun. I suppose she learned that on the stage." Right? Among the common people, Mrs. Merrick and her daughters, even after Mira's passionate avowal of her Jewishness, quote, hoped that the intensity of Mira's feelings about Judaism would slowly subside. And forthright Hans Merrick, who openly dislikes Jews, he is certain that Mira will eventually give up her religion. "She will see no Jew who is tolerable. Every male of that race is insupportable, insupportably advancing his nose." At that later point, when, you know, when he's already in love with her, he says with disgust, "Deronda's getting perfectly preposterous about those Jews." So, and one can also gauge the level of anti-Jewish prejudice by the degree to which the Jews in the book anticipated and instinctively respond to it. "I am English born," Mira responds to Daniel's original questions to her, adding, "but I am a Jewess. Do you despise me for it?" And though he answers, "Why should I? I am not so foolish," he later counsels her not to use the name Cohen for the stage. Now, the need of the pawnbroker, Ezra Cohen, to establish and reiterate his credentials is his way of overcompensating for the bias against him that he experiences as a Jew. And I'm not even including here the philosophic arguments for Jewish assimilation and against Jewish nationalism, which are expressed in the debate at the Hand and Banner, that may also be responding to the pressure of anti-Jewish prejudice. So I think that this is enough to suggest the prominence of this subject in the novel. But I also would like to emphasize that this anti-Jewish prejudice is not yet what can be called anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was a term that was coined in Germany at exactly the time when this book appeared. And it is a term that is coined, if not originally coined, but certainly the term was made popular by Wilhelm Marr, who conceived of anti-Semitism as an ideological movement that labeled Jews as the unfair beneficiaries of liberalism and charged Jews with using the so-called freedoms and rights of an open society to conquer Germany from within. And this is what he called his book, The Victory of Judentum, The Victory of Jewishness, of Judaism over Germanum, over Germany. That was the accusation. That is political anti-Semitism, very different from prejudice, bias of even the worst kind, a different kind of political formulation. So anti-Semitism set out to forge an alliance among various anti-liberal forces, like religious conservatives on one hand and radical nationalists on the other. And it did so under a banner of rational progress toward a strong national state. Although anti-Semitism drew its ammunition from Christian and earlier anti-Jewish sources and shared many of the same prejudices, it also fed on Karl Marx's identification of the Jews with the evils of capitalism, and it quite deliberately distinguished itself as a rational political idea, owing nothing to religious or superstitious biases. Eliot was by that time very closely familiar with trends in German society, and she was as familiar with them as she was with the political ideas circulating in England. And she gave this a name. She didn't yet have the term anti-Semitism. What she called this incitement against the Jews was the modern hep, hep, hep. And this was a term which the Crusaders used when they were rampaging against the Jews on their path to fight the Muslims. And the term is thought to be, where does this, hep, 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 it sounds as if you're going after someone, but it's thought that this is an acronym from Hierosolima Perdita, Jerusalem is lost, meaning lost to the Jews. And it was what they said to the Jews, you have lost Jerusalem. It wasn't one of the things. You are accursed people, and it's God who has even accursed you. You have lost. This was a taunt that was always, the Jews were taunted by this. So chase the Jew, in other words, and humiliate him with reminders of his exile. And here is how, immediately after she wrote this book, Daniel Deronda, she wrote this essay called The Modern Hep Hep. And here is how George Eliot describes the thinking behind this modern movement. The Jews, she writes, the Jews, it is felt, have a dangerous tendency to get the uppermost places, not only in commerce, but in political life. Their monetary hold on governments is tending to perpetuate in leading Jews a spirit of universal alienism, euphemistically called cosmopolitanism, even when the West has given them a full share in civil and political rights. A people with Oriental sunlight in their blood, yet capable of being everywhere acclimatized, they have a force and toughness which enables them to carry off the best prizes, and their wealth is likely to put half the seats in Parliament at their disposal. Please understand, this is not George Eliot writing in her own voice. This is George Eliot already formulating this level of anti-Semitism, which she was calling the modern hep hep. So she was struck by the way this new movement had now begun to attack Jews, not for their inferiority, but rather out of obvious jealousy and fear that the ethnic natives would not be able to compete with Jews on the level playing field, on the terms of liberty and equality that the government was putting into place. She saw exactly what the emerging anti-Semites saw, namely the remarkable phenomenon of this scattered people that rose so brilliantly when given the chance. She admired and welcomed what others feared. She saw and feared that the Jewish achievement could be turned into an excuse for this modern hep hep, and that the traditional fox hunt could now morph into the political Jew hunt, as was indeed happening. Was George Eliot concerned over the fate of the Jews? Assuredly, and we will get to that. But of more immediate concern to her was the corrupting effect of this prejudice on those who experienced it. First, It deflected attention from problems endemic to British society that could no longer be ignored. As you see, starting with the hereditary aristocracy that had outlived its function and was abusing its unearned privilege. Second, it blamed the Jews for problems of modernity, such as this universal alienism that was actually common among young people like Gwendolyn, who were now being raised with no spiritual training or national consciousness. Here was an actual rootless and alienated constituency, and what was to be done with people untrained for any meaningful work? Third, blame of others was the result of insecurity that fostered ever greater lack of self-confidence, so that the cycle of anti-Jewish prejudice was bound to create an ever less self-reliant and competent British society. The modern hep-hep, in other words, seeping into the country, also through continental philosophy, was dangerous to England. To learn to appreciate the Jews was to save England from perdition. And so we see how Daniel Deronda emerges as a moral guide to everyone's better nature. The way in which Daniel becomes a hero, in a sense, is as the alternative to a grand court, that in this society, which is becoming so fragile when people don't know the other person very well, and they don't know what to make of them very well, he is someone who wants to know other people, who tries to know other people, and he has the strange desire and need to be of help to other people, especially women. He is looking for his lost mother, and he feels vulnerable himself because he doesn't know where he comes from. And the form that that takes in him is to try to be helpful to others. This corresponds, I think, to the author's role in relation to her readership. Eliot was hopeful that England's reactionary prejudice was open to correction. By engaging sympathy on the behalf of a Jewish refugee, portraying the normalcy of a Jewish family and business, teaching something about Jewish history, religion, and folkways, and correspondingly by demonstrating the pettiness of anti-Jewish prejudice, she hoped to save England from what she saw happening in Germany. And Deronda, the character in the book, were the key to her strategy. And I think that when we come now to the emergence of this national theme and the urgency with which Mordechai, now from his perspective, entirely from an internal need, begins to hold forth on the importance of the Jews reclaiming their homeland in the land of Israel, I think that one sees behind it also the really cumulative fears about evil as she saw it emerging in England, and the one she thought was necessary in order to really stave off the local problems. So we'll go on. Thanks. It's interesting that the evildoers in this book, you'd find it hard to put them in jail. In other words, they're not criminals in the most obvious sense. They exploit their own constituencies. So when we see Grand Court being introduced for the first time, you see that everyone is so eager for him to come to Diplo because everybody thinks that they're going to lick the bone, that they're going to get something from him. And so he's almost accorded the kind of grandeur that comes with grand court. He is accorded all that privilege because everybody thinks that they will benefit from it. And Gwendolyn, who becomes his victim, her first thought is, well, I could get to rule this man, and that might take me out of my personal predicament. So in each case, the villain is indeed villainous, but he exploits the weakness of the society in the sense that they are still willing to accept that old aristocratic structure that gave him this power, although there's nothing that he exercises it in anymore. He doesn't have to do anything to gain that power. And so feeling a little bit as if he's an empty shell, he exerts it through this sadistic desire to control people under him and to make them suffer. So this is a new form of imposing your will on others. And Lapidoth, Mira's father, also exploits his own people. It's interesting that he knows that he can get away with anything because Mira is so loyal. She is such a good daughter that she would never send him to jail, never send him to prison. So in each case, the evildoers here are exploiting something within their society that they are being allowed to get away with.
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.